Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Okay, so try this for me as we get going today, if you would. Underwear, paint, and ketchup. What do they all have in common? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Thursday, the 14th of February. Good as always to have you with us. Consider, if you would, ketchup. Tomatoes, vinegar, sugar, a little bit of salt. Not much more to it than that. And yet it is on top of that humble condiment that the H.J. Heinz Company built a $28 billion empire. That's what Warren Buffett and his partners paid this morning to buy it, lock, stock, and barrel. Nancy Kane is a business historian at Harvard University. Nancy, good to have you with us.
Pleasure to be here, Kai.
So what is it about Heinz that makes it so special? I mean, $28 billion is a whole lot of money.
It is, but, you know, they're buying some very good DNA. If you think about it, you know, this is a brand like, you know, FedEx, if you will, or Coke or Starbucks more recently, that has become the placeholder for the category, right? So we don't think about ketchup without picturing the Keystone label, even if we wouldn't call it that.
I didn't know that's what it was called, the Keystone label.
Yeah, there you go, right? Sure. And when we ask for ketchup and we don't get Heinz, wherever we are, you know, there's just a little bit of a reboot
as
we think
wrong,
about
right?
That.
If it's not a Heinz bottle, it looks wrong.
It looks wrong. And so, you know, that's a really powerful brand.
How is it, to paraphrase Malcolm Gladwell from a couple of years ago, how is it that there's like a zillion different kinds of mustard, but really only one kind of ketchup?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I think part of it is that Heinz owned the category for a long, long time. It's not that there weren't other catsups around in the late 19th and early 20th century. It's just that Heinz, through a series of, you know, I think production and marketing and distribution and even regulatory innovations and initiatives, you know, really gained dominion, as we would say in old-fashioned parlance. That's the first thing. But the second thing is that a lot of the foods that grew up with ketchup, you know, including, you know, in the 1950s, fast food, right, grew up literally in tandem with alliances or supply relationships with Heinz. And then add one other piece to it. Around the world, Heinz plays with its recipes a little bit so that each country has a ketchup that tastes, you know, like those taste buds like it to taste.
So do you get like, this is an extreme, but do you get like curry ketchup in India and I don't know, something else, someplace else?
Yeah, you do. You get tiny variations. I don't think you get curry ketchup in India, but you get something that has perhaps a little more paprika or a little more chili pepper.
Wow.
Interestingly enough, American ketchup, and we think of American taste buds as blander than many, is a little spicier than most ketchups that Heinz produces for specific national markets. So we're a little zippier than we realized.
Who knew?
Who knew?
I'm pretty much a straight French fries and ketchup kind of guy. What about you?
Oh, I slung eggs and hash browns to put myself through college at a truck stop in central Illinois. So I do ketchup on meatloaf. No. I do ketchup on eggs. I do ketchup on hash browns. I've been known to do ketchup on mayonnaise with white bread and call it a blood sandwich. Oh, yeah, seriously.
Nancy Kane, she somehow wound up at Harvard despite eating that. Nancy, thank you so much.
Real pleasure, Kai.
The way Warren Buffett invests through his company Berkshire Hathaway sort of seems a little bit like he's going shopping. So what would you have in your shopping cart if you went shopping only from the companies that Buffett owns or controls a chunk of? Well, you'd have a full basket, just not a very healthy one. A bottle of Heinz ketchup as of today. Dairy Queen, so you'd have some ice cream, some Oreos, a little Coca-Cola, some See's candy. A balanced portfolio, not necessarily a balanced diet, right? Buffett's holding company, Berkshire Hathaway, by the by, owns Fruit of the Loom and Benjamin Moore Paints, hence the trivia quiz up on top of the broadcast. On Wall Street today, another split decision very narrowly. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We got earnings today from Cabela's. Cabela's is, to quote them, the world's largest direct marketer of hunting, fishing, camping, and related outdoor merchandise. Also, they sell a lot of guns and ammunition. Revenues were up 15% last quarter, in large part, the company says, because of a surge in sales of guns and ammunition. That's what happens when more restrictive gun laws are being talked about, as they are right now. New York passed one such law a couple of weeks ago, which has displeased some gun makers. Marketplace's David Gura explains.
After New York State passed its new gun law, Brian Schutz talked to his staff.
It just didn't make sense to us.
Schutz co-owns Olympic Arms. His company specializes in AR-15s, a firearm that's now illegal in New York State.
If a citizen, you know, can't own it, I don't understand the reasoning why the law enforcement community should have it.
And from now on, they won't be able to have any Olympic Arms guns. Schutz says the manufacturer won't do business with the state of New York. LaRue Tactical made the same decision, and so did a company called EFI. It makes long-range precision rifles. Its president, Melinda Metter, says there shouldn't be exceptions for a police officer or a sheriff.
If I can't sell it to a member of the public, I'm not selling it to him.
EFI added New York to a list that already includes Washington, D.C., Chicago, and California, places that also have strict gun laws. Metter estimates government sales account for about 10% of her business.
To tell you the truth, Dave, we're not worried about it.
John Griebert is the executive director of the New York State Association of Chiefs of Police, a group that supported the new gun law in New York State.
I think it's pretty unfortunate that any business thinks that they can bully us.
Griebert says people in law enforcement have, in his words, a greater right to weapons to deal with potentially violent situations because they deal with criminals every day. And Griebert says he's confident police will still have access to the equipment they need to get the job done right. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
There's big talk in the publishing world this week. Two names are involved, one of which we all know, Time Warner. It owns, in addition to the venerable Time magazine, People, InStyle, Real Simple, and a whole bunch of others. The company has now decided it wants to offload most of its titles with the help of name number two, which you are perhaps not quite as familiar with. Meredith. Marketplace's Eve Tro explains it's all about the ladies.
If the publishing world is high school, Time might be starting quarterback and debate team captain. Meredith is more president of the Home Economics Club.
Today I'm going to show you how easy it is to boil an egg. First, place the fresh eggs in a saucepan.
That's a YouTube video from Family Circle, one of Meredith's many women's lifestyle titles. The company lives in Des Moines, Iowa. Better Homes and Gardens is its mainstay. Amy Colton at Current Marketing says Meredith is more about useful advice than high fashion.
The practical side of things has done really well, especially in this economy.
Plus, moms love magazines. Colton's surveys show the majority of them read 1 to 3 magazines regularly, in printed form.
They like to kick back on the couch, soak in the bathtub. It's just their way of escaping and holding a magazine and enjoying it.
Rick Edmonds follows media business at the Poynter Institute. He says Meredith doesn't make huge profits, but for publishing, it's pretty strong.
Certainly any newspaper company would be clicking its heels if it had done that well.
Time and Meredith could create a new publishing company to appeal mostly to women. By spinning off titles, Time will end its reign as biggest magazine publisher in the U.S., but it will reportedly hold on to a few big names: Time Magazine, Fortune, and Sports Illustrated, which happen to have mostly male readers. I'm Eve Troeh for Marketplace.
When electric cars eventually make it big, this week may be looked at as a turning point, not so much in the development of EVs, but in how they're perceived by the public and written about by the press. This past weekend, the New York Times published a story about Tesla, its cars, and its new charging stations. Suffice it to say, it was not a story that Tesla founder and CEO Elon Musk was pleased with, seeing as how the car wound up on a flatbed at one point. Chelsea Sexton wrote about the whole brouhaha at Wired.com the other day. Good to have you with us.
Lovely to be here.
So was this a mistake by Tesla to let the New York Times try to do this in, 25-degree weather in New York?
It certainly wasn't the wisest PR choice, no.
And it has evolved now into what you might kindly call a yelling match between Tesla and the newspaper of record.
Yes, it's kind of a Twitter slap fight at this point. Bottom line, Tesla pitched a road trip story to the New York Times and is now unhappy with the story that the New York Times printed and is going after them for faking it and slanting it and the whole thing, when really it just wasn't the wisest trip to begin with, and it's not what the EV experience represents.
Well, let's expand on that a little bit. And we should say at the outset that Tesla has now released the logs of this trip from the car, which we will have on our website. But your point that you made in Wired the other day is there's this double standard that we've got with EVs now, that they have to be everything, even though our regular cars aren't everything.
Absolutely. No new product does absolutely everything in exactly the same way as the product it's replacing. And yet, when it comes to electric cars, that's the expectation.
Why do we have this double standard, do you think?
Well, people are used to being able to do whatever they've always done in the same way they've always done it. And quite often they have to experience the new product before they can understand why it's better. Once people drive them, they get it. We get this like, oh my gosh, it's a real car. It does everything a real car does. But before they have that chance to try it, they don't understand. And we're so busy trying to compete on the last 5% of the experience that EVs are not today the best car for. They're great for running around. They're great for day-to-day. They're great for commuting. They are not great for boat towing and road trips and off-roading. Neither is a Corvette.
So if Tesla ultimately loses this contest with the New York Times, and we obviously don't know how that's going to turn out, does that mean bad things for the whole EV industry?
This one incident isn't going to affect the overall EV industry. The more we keep setting ourselves up for these sorts of stories, the more we're shooting ourselves in the foot.
You make the comparison with the iPhone and how we have learned to love the iPhone, even though sometimes it's not a very good phone.
Not even just the iPhone, which at least has had the advantage of iterating a whole bunch of times. Original mobile phones, we joke about the old bricks we used to carry around.
Right.
They didn't have great talk time. They didn't have great range or reliability. They were not the same as a landline phone. They didn't try to be. And we got over it because ultimately they proved to be a better experience. We have to allow the same thing to happen with cars that have happened with phones or with DVRs, which don't produce a VHS tape for you to carry to your mom's house and share a TV show. That's not what they need to do anymore.
Have you driven a Tesla?
Many times.
You like it?
They're hot cars. They're gorgeous. They're sexy. They're fun. I love torque like no one really should. So I love Tesla cars. But other than the novelty of it, taking a road trip for the fun,
yeah,
I wouldn't suggest to somebody that it's the same experience that they'd have taking a gas car to Vegas.
Chelsea Sexton, she's a contributor to Wired, and she writes most recently about Tesla and the New York Times and that little disagreement they're having. Chelsea, thanks a bunch.
Thanks for letting me crash your party.
Coming up, Die Hardest?
I think there's a way to think about this, and it does not involve Bruce Willis.
He's got a new movie out, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials chipped off less than a 0.1% today, about 9 points, ended at 13,973. The NASDAQ gained a fraction of a percent, we'll call it 1 point, closed at 3,198. The S&P 500 picked up a fraction, also a point, finished at 1521. It did. Those big deals we were talking about earlier, Heinz as a catch-up, shares soared nearly 20% on news it would be bought by Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway and 3G Capital. Constellation Brands rocketed up 37% today because of another deal, the one between Anheuser-Busch InBev and Mexican beer giant Grupo Modelo. For its part, ABI sudsed up 5% today. Bonds rose a smidge. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.00% on the nose. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music. From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve reports on industrial production for January. A reading on consumer attitudes about the economy. The University of Michigan releases its preliminary February consumer sentiment survey. And it's where the whole idea of turning into a pumpkin at midnight began. On February 15, 1950, Cinderella hit the big screen. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. And for the romantics among you, men and women who might have suffered sticker shock when you picked up a bouquet of roses for Valentine's Day out at lunch this afternoon, take heart. Expensive though they may be, the price of a dozen roses hasn't really risen for years. Marketplace's Sally Herships explains how roses defy inflation for most of the year.
I wish I could tell you otherwise, but the rose business is not very romantic.
I mean, the industry overall is a very competitive industry.
Ben Powell is chief operating officer of Mayish Wholesale Florist. He says 30 years ago, we would have bought most of our roses from California. But then foreign competition made things thorny for American flower farmers.
The U.S. growers of cut flowers really haven't been a major factor in roses for probably 20 years.
Any roses you may have been lucky enough to receive today probably came from South America. Colombia and Ecuador grow the vast majority of roses sold in the U.S., and lower costs in those countries are one of the reasons prices here have remained the same for the past couple decades. In L.A. or New York, florists sell long-stem roses for about $70 a dozen. At the grocery store, a bouquet is just $10.
If you're buying it from a supermarket or a Costco or BJ's, Walmart, you're not paying for it to be put into a vase by a designer and put together and having a bigger presentation.
Christine Bolt works with the Association of Floral Importers of Florida. She says roses used to be just sold at florists, but now short-stem varieties at major retailers are also holding prices down.
But as we've been able to provide them in more places, we've not been able to sell it for more to the consumer.
But there's one caveat to rose pricing which the flower industry loves. On Valentine's Day, consumers can expect to pay more, even double. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
The world's second biggest economy has pretty much taken the week off, celebrating the Lunar New Year. Today is the fifth day of celebrations, and millions of Chinese are setting off fireworks in honor of the god of wealth. But wealth, or more accurately, the uneven distribution thereof, is a touchy subject over there. Just last week, the government in Beijing banned ads for luxury products on state-run television because of rising anger about the widening gap between the rich and the poor. Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz has been working on a series the past year or so about the lives and businesses along a single street in Shanghai. The Street of Eternal Happiness, it's called. Today, the story of a man on the losing end of that Chinese wealth gap.
The Lunar New Year came in with a bang on the Street of Eternal Happiness, just like it does every year. Apart from the fireworks, though, it's a quiet time for China. Shops are closed. The street's empty. It's a time to be indoors with family. But not for Zhang Naixun. His family is hundreds of miles away in his home village. The 62-year-old spends his New Year's Eve on the city sidewalk, head down, holding out a plastic cup for donations. Today, families taking a stroll along the Street of Eternal Happiness are feeling generous. A father walking with his children slides Zhang a paper bill.
You're not returning home for the New Year?
No, sir.
Here you go. Happy New Year.
I wish you happiness and prosperity, sir. Thank you. I'm doing well today. It's the new year. I'm a lonely old beggar on the street. People feel sorry for me.
Zhang's long white hair covers the shoulders of his dirty green trench coat. Every afternoon, he comes to this intersection to spend the evening in front of a row of bars, restaurants, and massage parlors that don't close until late. When foot traffic dies down, he rummages through trash cans looking for bottles. He sells them to recyclers for 2 cents apiece. During the day, Zhang sleeps in a makeshift bed underneath a staircase in a rundown apartment building across town.
I left home 12 years ago because my family didn't have enough to eat.
China began market reforms 35 years ago. Since then, strong and steady GDP growth has lifted more than half a billion Chinese out of poverty. But the number of people in China who still live on less than $2 a day is equal to the entire population of the United States. It's a fact often hidden behind the headlines of China's newfound wealth. Zhang grew up in a mud house in rural Hunan province. He and his wife have 3 sons and 8 grandchildren. China's one-child policy is often ignored in rural China. The sons work at factories hundreds of miles away, leaving their children with Zhang's wife on the family's tiny plot of land.
My wife and I can't read or write, nor can any of my sons, but my grandchildren are learning this at school. Our hope is that they become literate.
Old traditions run strong in Zhang's hometown, traditions that have always made Zhang hesitant to return home.
When I went back last summer, my sons, daughters-in-law, and grandchildren all kneeled and kowtowed to me. It's a Chinese tradition, but I don't like it, and I ask them not to do it.
A similar Chinese tradition is what spurred Zhang to leave home in the first place.
It was during the New Year holiday, and my sons made my wife and me eat the holiday meal first, before everyone else. It's a tradition, but that year we didn't have enough food for everyone. I said, my grandchildren don't even have enough to eat. Our sons wouldn't budge, so I left. Now I send money home and feel like I'm doing my part.
It's been 12 years since Zhang has spent the New Year holiday with his family. This year, his sons begged him to come home. To be alone without family during this holiday is, for the Chinese, almost sacrilegious. This yearning to return home has even spawned a musical genre in China, songs that are played over and over on the radio this time of year. This one is simply called Home, from musician Xu Wei.
拥抱着亲人的时候, 多希望时间就停止。
If only time could stop, sings Xu, when I'm hugging my family. I've been gone so long that now when I come home, I feel like a stranger. It's a feeling shared by hundreds of millions of Chinese migrants who are unable to see their children and their grandchildren grow up. And on the Street of Eternal Happiness, Zhang Naixun will spend today thinking of his family, who are lighting firecrackers to celebrate the god of wealth, while hundreds of miles away, he sits with his plastic cup, hoping others are willing to spread a little wealth. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Pictures, maps, videos, and more stories from the Street of Eternal Happiness at marketplace.org. Yeah, there's a lot of talk right now about all those Oscar-nominated films, but what about the flicks of the world, the movies? There is a presumptive new blockbuster out today, one you probably already know a lot about because it's part of a franchise that is hard to get rid of.
He's an easy guy to like and a hard man to kill.
You have no idea who you're dealing with.
It's hard to kill McClane.
Damn straight.
Bruce Willis is back. Wesley Morris is a film critic with Grantland. Wesley, it's good to have you back.
Nice to talk to you, Kai.
So here comes perhaps the most obvious question in the history of obvious questions. Die Hard 5, seriously?
I mean, I think there's a way to think about this, and it does not involve Bruce Willis per se.
Okay.
I think it involves a lot of finance people sitting around thinking, dude, I think there's still some water left in this sponge.
That's crazy.
you know, and this one is called A Good Day to Die Hard. I mean, it just, I feel like there's some Estonian who is basically putting what he'd like to call the movies through a translator, and this is what it comes out as.
With apologies to Estonians. You've seen it, right? Die Hard 5?
I have seen it. And what watching this movie, though, you really do get a sense that the action movie is in a really bad way.
Well, all the rest of them, I mean, all the rest of the action heroes, right? Schwarzenegger, who was in The Expendables not too long ago, and Stallone, for crying out loud, with a bullet to the head a couple of weeks ago. I mean, those guys are all not young people. But audiences are going to go see this movie, Wesley, right?
Of course they are, yes. But here's the thing. There are two different approaches to the action movie situation, and the original Die Hard movies was a really fresh approach that basically changed for a long time the kind of action movies we got. I think that we have sort of grown past this idea of an action hero in some ways, and I think that the movies aren't helping us out by basically regurgitating stuff it has always done without trying to find a new way to do it.
Well, why have we grown past that? I mean, are we now smarter about bad movies, or has society just changed?
It's not just so much that we're smarter about bad movies. I think the need for the action heroes, we knew it. Those guys have now been upstaged by stunt crews and effects houses.
And also, if you're paying $12.50 a whack, I'm not going to see a bad movie for $12.50. Maybe it's just me that's cheap, but
no, you want to see a car transform into a spaceship, transform into a planet that then eats
Optimus
another
Prime.
Planet. I mean, yeah, exactly. I mean, you want to see, and you know, say what you want about those Transformers movies. They are state-of-the-art special effects, and Michael Bay is a sort of evil genius. He has figured out a way to do this without having to deal with the overhead of an ego like Stallone's or Schwarzenegger's. And I don't see that sort of coming back around without a complete rethinking of how an action movie is supposed to work.
Right. Wesley Morris, he writes on films at Grantland. Wesley, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, Kai. Have a great weekend.
You too, man. But I'm not going to see this movie, by the way.
You are doing the right thing.
All right. Good. See ya.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, returning to the theme du jour, mergers and acquisitions. That deal in which U.S. Airways becomes part of American Airlines doesn't just involve those two carriers, you know. If you go all the way back, and just with American, the genealogy goes like this. Canadian Colonial Airways, Colonial Western Airways, Colonial Air Transport, Texas Air, St. Tammany Gulf Coast, Robertson Aircraft, Braniff Airlines, but not that Braniff Airlines, Northern Airlines, Central Airlines, Continental Airlines, but not that Continental Airlines, Century Airlines, Southwest Fast Express, Trans-Caribbean Airways, Air California, Reno Air, TWA, Pittsburgh Aviation, Transcontinental Air Transport, Maddox Airlines, Western Air Express, Pacific Marine Airways, West Coast Air Transport, Pacific Air Transport, Ozark Airlines. And that's not even talking about U.S. Air and its history. We've got a graph of all of that stuff on our website. It's marketplace.org. A lot of airlines. All right, we're done. APM and Marketplace, you know the drill. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Ethan Lindsay, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Kai Rizdal. We're out of here. We'll see you tomorrow. And this is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.